Like, I look to Nina Simone, I'll look to bell hooks, I look to Sylvia Rivera and Julia de Burgos to give me strength and to just continue the work that I've been trying to do.
Alinda Segarra, leader of the band Hooray for the Riff Raff, and 2014 American songwriter, named the Body Electric the Song of the Year. NPR declared it the political folk song of 2014. Alinda's new album, The Navigator, is out this week. Visit our website at democracynow.org to see our full interview with Alinda Segarra's full performance in our studio. And that does it for our show in the special on International Women's Day. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gatt, Diener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Renee Feltz, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Happy International Women's Day, and it is just 8 o'clock. Coming up this morning on The Boo, at 9, we have the premiere of Politics of Living, a new show created in response to the 2016 election to elevate women's voices on political, economic, and cultural issues. At 10, a bilingual special program on human trafficking, broadcast in English and Spanish. At 11, philanthropy through a Black woman's lens, an interview with the major giving director of the MRG Foundation. And at 11:30, what is trans feminism? A look at the intersection of gender identity and feminism. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. Now, stay tuned for a Bread and Roses special, countering Western-centric narratives, stories of resistance from transnational women and non-binary agents of change.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S.-made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
Welcome to a special International Women's Day edition of Bread and Roses. I'm one of the hosts for today, Pamela Santos. You don't usually hear us at this time, so I'll give you a little primer on Bread and Roses. Bread and Roses usually airs from 6 to 7 p.m. every Friday. Bread and Roses is the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country, providing news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have fun. We want our bread and roses too. Get it? We believe a woman's place is at the head of the struggle. Bread and Roses presents stories of resistance from transnational women and non-binary agents of change. On this International Women's Day, we counter the narrative that non-Western women are in need of white saviors. Today, you'll be hearing stories and music by various artists and activists. Enjoy the program.
I recently interviewed Sara Acevedo, and I asked her to talk about white saviorism. You'll hear the full conversation with her on March 17th at 6 p.m. on Bread and Roses. Today, here's a segment where she talks about her identities around being a Colombian mestiza autistic woman. She then talks about issues of erasure and ableist violence that she heard in Gloria Steinem's speech for the Women's March on January 21st.
My name is Sara Maria Acevedo. I was born and raised in Colombia. I've been here since 2009. In 2012, I came to San Francisco to get my doctoral degree in anthropology and social change with a focus on disability justice. I'm at the California Institute of Integral Studies. I reclaimed the mestiza identity. The idea of mestizaje actually translates as mixture between the indigenous peoples of the Americas and the European colonizers. And I reclaim it because I believe it's important to highlight the very horrible and very real and very concrete ways of sexual colonizing. I am autistic. And I am a PhD student. I am a PhD candidate, actually. I'm all ABD, all about dissertation, and I'm hoping to defend my dissertation in early 2018. I'm excited about that.
I've always felt that we need all of the voices, right? That we need all of the voices, that in decentering, we got to make sure that we don't tokenize, I feel like. And I feel like that can be accomplished by incorporating all of the voices together and in critical conversation around what each voice is cannot provide, and therefore why it's important that there is always a multiplicity of voices together, thinking together, creating together, editing each other, and so on and so forth. So I had no political or simply political or capricious idea around why I should discount white feminism. There's many white feminists, anthropologists, who were actually initiators of that turn, that postmodern turn. I don't necessarily think that an identity politics that excludes white feminism just for default is generative. And the ways in which the statement of unity, for instance, that came out of the women's march leadership was very, very offensively speaking of disability. In the perpetual framework that we are portrayed, which is dependents in need of care, we're not producers, we're not contributors, we're not workers, we're not mothers, we're not anything except for recipients of charity and of care. So that was a punch in the stomach to begin with. But I wasn't surprised, to say the least. I mean, I wasn't surprised. I was hurt, as I always am, and I was infuriated, but I wasn't surprised. And then that was followed by the removal of sex workers from the Statement of Unity, from the Women's March. And so, I mean, you know, that is also saying that disabled women aren't sex workers, which is not true. I feel that there was already in me a rejection to sort of this very white platform of the Women's March, which absolutely had, but listen, like, pay attention to what I'm saying, had Black women participate, right, in the leadership, because it looks good, because it's convenient, and again, it's not decentering whiteness, but it's tokenizing Blackness. I was already very disillusioned with the leadership. I'm not talking about the show up. I'm not going to talk about the constituents, the actual women who took to the streets. I'm talking about the leadership of the march. And I do know that there was a lot of disabled women that were creating actions and initiatives around the Women's March and who were saying, well, we're going to march. You know, we're here. We're going to march. And they were creating their own sort of like platforms and constituents and talking about the importance of disabled women and sort of like debunking the myth that women, that disabled people in general, but disabled women are only recipients of care and or charity and or pity and or so on and so forth. I was mesmerized by it. I always see the ways in which our collective forms of resilience are simply amazing, not because of they do something that is out of out of the world, or because they do something that is quote unquote inspirational, but because that is the ways in which we live in the everyday. So that we're just taking to the streets and doing what we do every day, resilience, but we're sort of like using this platform of the Youth Women's March to once again highlight the fact that we are perpetually excluded and neglected from leadership and organizing social movements. So anyway, that was my feeling the whole time. And I was reading different articles. Emily Ladeau wrote a really wonderful article around it. And many others did too. And there were ones that were wonderful about disabled women who could not participate either because they're neurodivergent or chronically ill and couldn't be physically present at the march. So how to be involved and how to follow up the disability constituency in the march. And all of those things for me are always beautiful. And they do not represent anything surprising for me. They just are the ways that we fight against these things in the everyday. When I was browsing through my Facebook and I saw Gloria Steinem, her speech, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go look at this and I'm going to see what's up. So the speech began really, really, really well. Again, I don't believe that we need to extricate white women from the struggle. It's all our struggle. It's all women's struggle, including trans women and non-binary people. So I was like, okay, well, she's mentioning Bernie Sanders and she's mentioning Hillary and she's mentioning other women. I mean, I don't remember exactly who she mentioned. It was mostly white people, but it's okay. And suddenly she starts talking about 45. And the way that she talked about 45 was so utterly demonizing to people with mental illness and to the community mental health movement, the MAT Pride movement. It was just simply so derogative and such a political tool, like such a populist political tool for getting to demonize one person who actually enjoys the most the benefits of whiteness, the benefits of wealth, the benefits of all of these intersections of privilege, and to call for the psychiatric establishment to actually issue an order to institutionalize this person because they show outright hate and bigotry. And so the conflation of hatred and bigotry with mental illness and neurodiversity, to me, was hands down the most egregious and the most dehumanizing tactic. You're trying to attack a person who actually enjoys the attention that these insults and that these, I guess, attention directed at this person coming from all corners is something that seems to be just important for this person's platform, leadership platform, at the expense, at the material, concrete expense of people in the community mental health movement, in the MAD Pride movement, and people with mental illness, neurodivergent people, seeking access to dignified, humanizing services. What does that do? What does that do to Black, queer, disabled women seeking access to mental health services in the everyday? What is the conflation of white hatred and bigotry with mental illness? What does that do to the realities of people in the everyday who are always already marginalized, always already isolated, always already stigmatized? I mean, what does that do to women? If it's the Women's March, what is white saviorism in this case doing to women without necessarily having to address the desperate state of Black and brown women around the world? you don't need to even talk about that. All you have to do is demonize a white person, a white male, in this such way that the ripple effects obviously will fall on black and brown, disabled, queer women. I mean, there's no, you don't have to think very hard about it to actually know that that's going to happen, or that's happened already. So increasing stigma and totally foreclosing dignified treatment and access and humanizing caring for the disability constituency, the disability, the various disability communities seeking access to mental health services, right? So you don't need to be very explicitly a white savior in talking about black and brown women around the world and how we are oppressed and we are victimized and we need white saviorism to get us out of our very violent, disparaging, horrible lives, which I'm not going to say. I'm not going to say that the lives of black and brown, queer, disabled women around the world are excellent, or that our quality of life, or that our access to community representation, to community leadership, to basic everyday life needs is easy or wonderful or beautiful or rosy, but we don't need a white woman to want to save us from these. What I do think is that we need white women to talk to other white women, and those white women to talk to other white women, and those white disabled queer women to talk to other white disabled queer women about the value of multiplicity, about the value of getting together in collectivity, and bringing on perspectives that are incomplete. We are always incomplete without each other, I think. So whatever I think as a brown, disabled, straight, cisgender woman will be fully incomplete without the perspective of a brown, disabled, queer, transgender woman. I think that Gloria Steinem cares for women's issues at large, not only white women's issues. I do think that. What I also think is that our histories, the history of disability, continues to be so marginalized within intellectual circles, within social justice movements, on the ground, within feminist issues, within political theory, within philosophy. And that's what I think happened to Gloria. And her speech is just not even within the realm of awareness and consciousness. But when is that enough of a good excuse? I think that a lot comes from outright ignorance and not knowing. And I also think that that is personal responsibility. With people with access to intellectual conversations like she does, to education like she does, to having the privilege to simply sit around and discuss these things, which I have, I think that that's a pretty good platform to depart and to start digging and looking. And there's certainly a wealth of materials out there authored by disabled people, disabled feminists, black feminists, transgender women on issues of disability. Enough so that I just don't buy it anymore. Ever since the whole speech and before that, I was feeling really, really tender around how such a huge movement and such a big thing, right? It was big phenomena. I was still not looking at disability in ways that would be meaningful to disabled people, not meaningful to them. To say, oh, let's name disability because, yeah, that looks good. Let's check all the isms and then talk about them. I feel very uplifted by other disabled women all the time. So I do have to say that we do collectivize and we do politicize ourselves even further around these issues. And I think that that's what we've always done.
This is Pamela Santos, and I'm here with the host from Tonali, another show on KBOO. I'm just going to have everyone introduce themselves.
Carmen Garnica.
And Yvonne Rivero.
Tonali es un programa que se enfoca específicamente en hablar en problemáticas que afectan a la comunidad latina, pero que a la vez ayuda a contribuir a la comunidad en general.
Denali is a program that focuses on issues, on community issues, but it also focuses on being able to present alternatives for a resolution of these problems.
También Tonali es un programa que está contribuyendo el apoyo voluntariado de mujeres.
And Tonali is as well a program that helps in developing, working together and supporting each other as women.
El programa ha tenido al aire más de 10 años, ha sido en vivo y todos los tiempos se tienen invitados especiales para poder desarrollar temáticas.
And the program has been in existence for over 10 years and we have all the time new guests that help us to think about giving solutions to this all of these problems that the community experiences.
Let's just talk specifically recently. I would say ever since November, some of the issues you've been covering on your weekly shows.
Si nos pudiera decir en desde noviembre aproximadamente, ¿cuáles son estos asuntos que ustedes han cubierto, sobre todo en términos de asuntos al corriente?
Una de las tensiones que la comunidad latina ha tenido desde octubre inicialmente ha sido el problema de que nos están asediando verbalmente políticas y personas en la presidencia hacia la comunidad inmigrante.
So one of the problems that we have been experiencing ever since October actually is that the hostile policies that we've felt, and then also this new presidency that has immigrants as a target.
Otro de los problemas es el que está afectando la separación de familias, el aspecto económico para poder la familia sustentarte en el trabajo y también creando temor en la comunidad.
And another one of the problems is the ability of families to sustain themselves economically, but also because there's so much fear, there's less an ability to be able to support your family. There's fears of family separation.
Y lamentablemente viene desde la cabeza que dirige el país, que viene es el presidente, y en el sector local, en el estado de Oregon, se está viendo afectada por los estudiantes que están rechazando la aceptación racial.
And it's regrettable to think that all of this is coming from the head of this country, which is the president. And at the state level, we're seeing that that communities and then people like the students are rejecting this racial profiling that we are seeing.
What kind of resistance have you been seeing?
¿Qué tipo de resistencia es el que han estado viendo?
En el aspecto comunitario, organizaciones para la comunidad se han estado organizando para poder hacer paros comunitarias en el aspecto civil sin fines de tener violencia. Todo ha sido tranquilo.
And at the community level, there's organization to have peaceful strikes. And these are movements that had been coming from the citizenry itself, I mean from the very community. You know, there's no aggression in these movements. There's continuous movements to stop work and do other strikes.
También se está apoyando a la comunidad para buscar personas que den servicios, ahuyentando, informando cuáles son las medidas necesarias para poder mantener segura la familia y unida.
And then we're looking also for volunteers to be able to inform the community on what families and parents can do to keep their families together.
So I'm reminded of a very emotionally harrowing video I saw on social media where a 13-year-old daughter had to watch her father be taken away by ICE, and this had taken place in Los Angeles. I would say within a couple of days or so, there was a response here in Portland with Portland Public Schools sending information to families. What have you seen about how parents are responding, or I would say, how is the community responding in facing this danger together?
Estoy recordando un video que vi en los medios sociales, un video espantosísimo, en donde una pequeña observaba la separación de su padre, quien era siendo llevado por la migración, por ICE. Y la separación, esto ocurrió en una escuela en Los Ángeles, y quisiera preguntarles cuál es la respuesta local. Según recuerdo, un par de días pasados de que se hizo viral este video, la mesa directiva de Portland publicó, de las escuelas de Portland, de las escuelas públicas, publicó ciertas informaciones para prevenir a los padres, informar a los padres sobre esto. ¿Qué es lo que usted ha visto en su comunidad?
Mi nombre es Carmen Garnica. Soy voluntaria del programa Tonali.
My name is Carmen Garnica and I'm a volunteer at Tonali, at the Tonali radio program.
También hago voluntariado en Unite Oregon, anteriormente CIO.
And I'm also a volunteer at Unite Oregon, formerly CIO.
El lunes pasado,
last Monday,
hicimos un rally.
We put together a rally
afuera del edificio de ICE.
Right outside the ICE detention center in Portland.
Y se llamó Saliendo de las Sombras.
And it was named Coming Out of the Shadows.
Y esto fue con la razón de mostrarle a la comunidad que está bien tener miedo.
And this was motivated by the desire to show the community that it is okay to be fearful, to have fear.
Pero también es importante que sepamos cómo manejar ese miedo, cómo podemos canalizarlo de una manera más productiva.
But it is also important to know how to channel that fear, how we can use that fear that we're feeling, and then create something positive out of it.
Una de las personas que son más o están siendo más afectadas por toda esta situación que se está viviendo son los niños.
Some of the people that are receiving the greatest impact from all of this events is the children.
Hemos escuchado por parte de la comunidad cómo los niños enfrentan esta situación. En algunos casos, ellos están siendo mandados a terapias.
And we have listened from different parts of the community how the children are facing this situation. How many in our community are having to go to mental health therapy?
Los niños son muy receptivos. Los niños tal vez no mencionan nada, pero ellos están muy atentos de todo lo que está pasando.
And children are very receptive. Children do not miss anything. They know what's happening. Perhaps they don't say anything, but they're aware of what's happening.
Nuestra responsabilidad como padres, como adultos, como comunidad, debemos darles esa seguridad que ellos necesitan para que sean unos buenos seres humanos cuando crezcan.
And our responsibility as parents, as community members, and as their guides is to give them the best example that we can, hoping that they will become productive citizens in the future.
Una de las maneras para que podamos darles esa seguridad y tranquilidad es que nosotros nos mantengamos informados.
And one of the ways that we can give our children that sense of security and safety is for us to maintain ourselves informed.
Informados y unidos y mantener una actitud positiva.
Informed and in unity and maintaining a positive outlook.
Rebel, see I'm a rebel with a cause, fighting for it all, fighting for it all, my friend.
Show your humanity. I stand con las familias separadas por la frontera, yelling to the administration, not one more deportation. I'm singing for indigenous stolen generation. May the children find their dream time in this conversation. I rebel against industry that destroys cultures, mining for minerals, turning children into soldiers for all women.
If you're tuning in, this is Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Pamela Santos. And this is a special edition for International Women's Day.
At the time I went to Uganda, northern Uganda, to research, I was 35 years old. And I was very much in a moment in my life where I had toured a show about depression and suicide called Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. This is a different show that I won't be bringing to Portland this time around. But it was a pretty intense show. And I witnessed in the 8 years while I was touring that show, like, everything about the world shifted, as it does, that the theater didn't have that immediate response that YouTube suddenly had to respond to the world, or Twitter had to respond to the world. I witnessed a lot of my friends start their own families and stop coming to my shows because they had to take care of their kids, or they couldn't get childcare, or, you know, they just off to something else. They weren't young and 20 anymore. And I just wasn't sure why. I was just like, why am I making work anymore? What's the point of theater? And when in theory you can have so many more people see a tweet or a video, but that you can't really hit that same level of nuance in a viral video or a tweet, for sure, right? I was just like, I just want to do something I've never done before. And that's go to northern Uganda. And I never had that Peace Corps experience after college. Right after college, I worked for a nonprofit arts organization and was pursuing my artistic career. And I'm sort of guilty of having an eat, pray, love moment, right? Like an existential crisis, eat, pray, love moment. And raised all this money to go to Uganda. It was about $4,500. And worked for a microloan organization. And I wasn't enlightened. There was no magic brown person who told me something about how to live my life. I just had to confront with every single interaction how much privilege and oppression I was complicit in just by being an American. And I know that that might be difficult for some people to understand, but other people who have traveled abroad, you really... The colonialism is much more pronounced, and what you look like to other people. For me, I was a Mzungu over there. I'm a white person over there. The first day I was there, and I really think it's because they're busy trying to run their organization and they don't really know what else to have me do in 3 weeks that I wouldn't screw up. They have me judge their Women for Peace Award. This is like, I just arrived and I'm supposed to pick who is the woman most worthy of this award, which means, you know, this award given to them for working so hard for peace in northern Uganda. I just got there. I literally am off the boat. But as a Mzungu, that's like this honorable thing. This is I'm now this ambassador when I'm really just a crazy playwright in America, you know. So, I mean, here's another situation, white privilege. As a Chinese American over there, as I made a hit rap album. I literally was walking along the street, saw these boys, was invited to go to this dark room behind them, and naively thought they were the gay community of Gulu because two of the men were holding hands. All the codes are switched in my head. And I'm like, oh, they're organizing in the street. So I followed all these strange men into this dark room. And it turns out to be a music studio. And that night I started recording a rap album with them. And I don't think I could have done that if I had a child on my arm. Maybe I could have. But it definitely would have made things really different and a lot more expensive. And I tell the story in the show, after I gave out the award to these women in the most awkward way possible, because that's who I am, complete butthead, right? And as I hand out this big award, someone in America messages me on Facebook and is like, can you help me? I have old clothes. Can you help me get it over there to help some people in need? And I'm like, I just gave awards out to well-dressed women who, yes, were kidnapped by Joseph Kony's army, but are also now organizing to on behalf of these women to fight against gender-based violence, right? And you want me to drag your old dirty clothes from Orange County, California, halfway around to Gulu to like throw at these award winners? Are you serious? Like, this is how you really think? But this is, you know, that's a very naive thing that Americans think. Like, oh, I have old clothes. You want to bring them over there? Like, that is such a stupid use of my time. And it's such an insult to all the women that I've met who are much, you know, who are much better than your stupid dirty clothes. Like, this is, it doesn't look like this footage of, like, BBC footage of a refugee camp where, you know, kids are covered in flies and, like, following the reporter with, like, this empty look in their eyes. Like, that's, like, the footage that I'd seen my entire life as an American.
Just, this is what is going on in the other parts of the world, but you're only seeing the war.
Yeah. Yeah, and not people who are functional or people who will start their own organizations to change their lives. And the narrative very much becomes we as Americans or we as civilized Westerners have to go over there and help them. We have to send them money. We have to give them our old dirty clothes. We have to, and it completely strips people of dignity, and it completely erases this idea that people are actually capable of self-determining their own lives. And that became very clear when I got there. Like, I just remember every moment was so shocking to me. And I feel so silly now when I think about, like, well, of course people have jobs and can function and raise families and laugh and tell jokes. But, you know, the image is so harsh and stark, and it's created this dangerous single narrative. Like, in my mind, I had thought that the Civil War took over the entire country when it was actually isolated above the Nile River in that country, which is why it was able to grow so crazy, is because, you know, you have to cross over the river and to this more rural area. But it's also the British colonized Uganda, and they had determined that government type stuff would happen in the south where the capital would be, and all the farming would happen in the north. And so there's existing kind of squabbles between tribes that became full on tension, which blew out into the Civil War. So it's not that, like, people were inherently uncivilized. It's like, guess what? The West keeps creating borders in places which blow out these tensions, and now we have these civil wars, and then suddenly we're like, okay, well, no, we'll fix it. When we made that happen.
Jane Vogel, founder of the Portland nonprofit Age and Gender Equity in the Arts, was on KBOO recently talking about the symposium she spearheaded on March 3rd and 4th. It was called Unconscious Bias Symposium, Achieving Gender Equity in the Arts. Here, she talks a little bit about how she came to work in the arts and why. She also talks about the distinction between a social justice approach of respecting all aspects of all people's identities versus the white fragility statement of all lives matter.
So I wanted to be an actor. An actress is what we called it back then. I wanted to be an actress from the time I was about an elementary school child. And our family had come over as refugees from Indonesia by way of the Netherlands. And so I spent a lot of time writing plays and starring in them. And then when I got to high school, that was when my father, who was a very lovely, protective man, pulled me aside and told me that he would forbid me to go into acting, because he said in America they do bad things to women who become actresses. And he had done his research and heard the stories about Judy Garland back then, and that wasn't what he wanted for me. And so I became a trauma psychologist, and it wasn't until I was in my mid to late 40s when he passed away that I realized that that dream was still alive. And so I decided to pursue that dream. And I have no regrets about that. I'm passionate about the arts. What surprised me was how women were treated still in the arts. And I don't know, I guess I hadn't seen it up close like that. And so I realized that I wanted to do something to see if I could make that different, and not me alone, but to bring people together to talk about it and to take some action steps and see what we could do. And so that's when I came up with the idea of age and gender equity in the arts, and the initial idea, which we are doing, and that is to raise money and to invite professional theater companies in Portland to take a look at their numbers, to take a look at who they're programming for with playwrights, who's doing the directing, who's doing the lead roles, and eventually we're also going to be including designers into that, and to see if they can make it more balanced, because people who identify as women represent 51% of the population, and we're anywhere from 17% to 30%, depending on what category we're looking at. We still have a long ways to go. So that is one aspect of it. And then the other idea I came up with is to have this symposium to just raise awareness about what does it really mean to create equity, to create gender equity. And another issue that I would like us to have a lot of conversation about is how we are addressing equity. That right now I'm seeing a school of thought that says that we need to do it in a compartmentalized, linear way, that we need to look at race or we need to look at disabilities, and some other time we're going to look at gender. And I completely disagree with that. I feel that when we look at race, if we take the women of color and don't bring them to the table, we are not going to make the progress that needs to be made. So I say we can't wait until we have successfully addressed the racial equity piece. No, we need to have the women be part of that solution. And so it needs to be in an intersectional way. And that's why I say the table is round. Everybody needs to come to the table. And we need to not talk about, okay, we're only going to talk about gender, folks, and we're not going to address race in this. Absolutely not. We're going to talk about humanity. And humanity is about gender. Gender is not binary. We're going to talk about race, we're going to talk about ableism, disabilities, we're going to talk about LGBTQ and what that means. We're going to talk about all of it.
Yeah. Now, I want to point out, this is different from All Lives Matters.
My understanding of what All Lives Matter means is that we don't look at what the Black experience is, and we only look at what all lives. No. What I'm saying is we look at Black Lives Matter, but it's not without the gender piece. It's looking at it in an what I call an integrated way. If we truly lived our lives as if all lives matter, then I'm all for all lives mattering. But the reality is that our institutions do not operate as if all lives matter. our institutions operate as if Black lives don't matter. And that is why we need to call attention to that. I think I might have said this metaphor before. I think about it as having more than one child and saying, you know, I'm going to feed and raise one child first, and then I'm going to come back and do the other one. It's not how it works. And being in my early 60s, which I'm very pleased to be in my early 60s, I have lived long enough where I have been in a period of time in history where we believed certain things to be true. And now, 20, 30 years later, we look back on that and we say, well, that wasn't true at all. And for me, it has humbled me. And so when I hear experts today speaking, I think, you know, 30 years from now, that may not be the way we think at all. And therefore, I like to always be curious and open. I also think that when we become experts, I think that we have a tendency to stop being curious and we stop questioning and learning, and that is not a good thing. And this whole issue about treating people with dignity, treating people who are vulnerable and who don't have access to resources, finding ways that they can empower themselves, that we can change the way we're living so that it's not adversely affecting them. That is such a complex and difficult situation, because when we have privilege, we don't like to give that up, particularly around power and money. We don't like to let go of that. And so even though I wear rose-colored glasses and I'm very optimistic, I also don't see equity as a final destination. I see it as a dynamic process that we must spend our lives working at, being curious about, and being open to the idea that inside of us lives this shadow where we are indulging in privilege and it is adversely affecting another person.
Brotaron los lirios, las ceibas inmensas, la lluvia acaricia la neblina densa. Un jilguero canta solo en la memoria, fragmentos de historia que no volverán.
I'm the healer, protector, the teacher of time, the nurturer, the fighter, the enemy of lies. Staying quiet and still I'm absorbing all stress until I explode, then I am civil unrest. I'm the hope that was born in Malala's heart, the dream of Sandra looking for a fresh start. I'm the will of Rayhan to keep Island safe, the fireborn in Annie after surviving rape. I'm a mother, a daughter, a grand and a great responsibility to support and create. I'm the fight against a corrupt prison system, standing on the front lines robustly resistant. I'm the key that unlocks every detention center, the cord, the blood, the mighty placenta. I am fierce, ferocious, and furiously strong. I am Mother Earth, and this is my song.
If people don't know about your history as a political prisoner of Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos, could you tell people a little bit of what that was like to leave your homeland, to leave your place of birth, I guess?
Well, it was traumatic, I must say. Mm-hmm. It was, you leave family, friends, every connection and all the familiar places that which are part of your consciousness. So it's a kind of like half dying. So you come to the United States and you're uncertain for the longest time as to who you are or what you are. Especially if you grew up in a country like the Philippines where there's no experience of racism. So to encounter this in the United States, I was quite puzzled. I couldn't understand it for the longest time. It took a while before I understood that this was racism. And then you want to keep continuing the journey. That was the main thing with me. That's why I was moving from place to place. Because it's like, you know, I came to the realization subconsciously that the earth is round, and if I keep moving, eventually I will get to the place where I started from. It was a very strange frame of mind.
Well, I'd like to hear where you think transnational and intersectional feminism can take up a role here in resisting fascism.
Well, as we have seen, one of the first casualties of this troubled man is this mother who died while, when she was caught in the band. And freedom of mobility is a very important aspect of women's rights. You know? As you know, we are revolting against all these fences and borders and isolationism which have been imposed on women since time immemorial. That's why mobility is very important to a feminist, you know, the right to escape, even as something as simple as a home that is violent. Yeah. So it translates from that, very simple fact, to a very huge fact of somebody being able to escape a country that is violent towards women. And we have actually, in a firm, handled issues like this when we had to deal with the mistress of a warlord in the Philippines who had to escape the Philippines to be able to build her own life. And he went transnational. He had her imprisoned by ICE. He filed for custody of her children, you know, in the United States and so on and so forth. And he could do this because he had power and money in the Philippines. His clan, by the way, is in partnership with Donald Trump. So, from our very own experience, this is one of those things that we had to protect the right and freedom of women to mobility. That's number one. And because of that, we have taken a very aggressive posture against the travel ban, against the right of people to escape violent and life-threatening situations, which for the most part, especially for the Middle East, these life-threatening situations have been created by the United States itself, you know. So it's kind of like you stay where we can bomb you.
Mm.
Yeah.
Something I think back on a lot, actually, recently is a statement I hear Jose Antonio Vargas say a lot is, we are here because you were there.
Yes, absolutely. And are there. We are here because you are there.
Still there. Still there.
Yeah, still there. And for many people, that's... But it's the general world outlook where trade and commerce are the most important things in the world, you know, where societies are, entire nations are being organized towards trade because this is where these big multinational corporations can make profit. So it is what Marx called the recasting of the entire world in the image of capital. And I mean, you know, we cannot exclude Russia, we cannot exclude China from that, even as we condemn the way it has flourished under U.S. imperialism. But so now we had demographic realities in the United States. We had so many children of those, well, I don't like to use the word immigrants. Affirm Hawaii has this hashtag, a nation of people deprived of their nations, which is what we are, basically. We did not choose to immigrate. Mm-hmm. We were compelled to immigrate. So this is the reality, okay? Because there were so many, like, objections to the use of the word immigrants, like a nation of immigrants. And, of course, the Native Americans, the First Nations, said, excuse me, we did not immigrate. And mm-hmm. Black people also say, we did not immigrate. We were brought here as commodity and slave labor, which is also true. But the changing demographics that we have now, we have children of people who have been deprived of their nations for the benefit of multinational corporations. It's very complex, and for a firm, you know, in particular, because we do work with certain parts of the indigenous people of the Americas, both north and south. It has been a long process of getting to where we can define ourselves as transnational women. That's why we say transnational women rather than immigrant women. Mm-hmm. Number one, a number of our members have actually been born or grew up here, but preserved their links to the civilization or societies where they came from, and second, continue to be interested. Now, in my particular case, I was at a very young age already exposed to so many histories, you know, because I'm mixed blood. So I could see where civilizations had the same theme and where they differed, but at the same time also understanding that a person can hold in his or her consciousness all the world views of these differing civilizations. And this is what makes Filipinos, I think, very, what they say, adaptable. They can adapt to anything. It's because we can shift from one perspective to another, so on. But it is now time to, like, define ourselves and to take a very strong position vis-a-vis our rights and our freedoms. We cannot be pro Duterte and anti-Trump, for instance, support one kind of fascism versus another kind of fascism, or oppose one kind of imperialism and accept another kind of imperialism. It is such a shame, because at this transitional period, when there is a redivision of the world going on, it is there is an opportunity. There is an opportunity to define ourselves as a distinct people, independent of major powers, major colonizing powers, you know. So I hope we don't waste it.
You've been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland. Thank you so much for listening. Many thanks to our engineer, and to our AM Public Affairs Director, Derek Crooks, and our Evening Public Affairs Director, Kanan Schlesinger. The music you heard today included the song Decolonize Your Mind by Gingy, Rebel by Oracle Jane Doe featuring Maya Jupiter, Madre Tierra by Maya Jupiter. Many thanks to our guests who shared their stories with us, Sarah Acevedo, the host of Tonali, Christina Wong, Jane Vogel, and Ninochka Roska. We always welcome new collective members, and if you're interested in joining us as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.fm. You can connect with us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can access our podcasts and share feedback or show ideas. Like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. And we are on Twitter, @BreadRosesRadio. Have a great day, everyone. They try to bury us, lady.